If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Why does identity matter so much? The right to know where you come from.
Imagine coming home for Christmas and mom suddenly tells you, daddy is not your real daddy. You have to think of who you are again. You have to construct a different narrative of who you are. Your story has become bigger and you want to see that story. You want to see it full and you want to have that picture on the wall for you to show to yourself. That is identity to me.
6 years ago, Laura Bosch was working for an NGO that campaigns for children's rights in the Netherlands.
And one of these days, a group of donor-conceived children would continuously ask me for my assistance.
They wanted Laura's help because now they were adults. They had concerns about the doctor who had given their mother's fertility treatment, Dr. Jan Carbat.
This was how the case came to my attention. And there were so many rumors. Mr. Carbat used sperm of a specific donor who had issues on the autism spectrum. Mr. Carbat mixed up his sperm, so potentially siblings were not siblings at all. He did not screen his donors. Mr. Carbat used his own sperm. It was just too much. Everybody knows something was wrong, but nobody was really looking into what we could do with these rumors. We need to find a way to get this into court. We should make a case out of this.
And that's what Laura did. In this episode, the daunting task of trying to get justice for Carbat's victims. And a secret recording that was passed on to Joey.
I get an anonymous audio tape
that contains some startling revelations about Carbat's legal, official family and how much they might have known about his deception.
And they spoke that they already knew in the family that there was something wrong.
I'm Jenny Kleeman, and from Something Else, this is The Immaculate Deception. Episode 6, The Nose Hair Trimmer. We're recording this in spring 2020, more than 11 years after Carbat's clinic was shut down and 3 years after the doctor's death. The fight to bring some kind of resolution to the people whose lives Carbat touched is still ongoing. A case is about to be heard in the Dutch courts that is their first opportunity to get any kind of justice. But it began in 2014, when Carbat was still very much alive and a group of people who were conceived at his clinic contacted Laura Bosch. Laura was training as a lawyer and working for an international children's rights NGO
called Defence for Children here in the Netherlands. And part of my work consisted of looking into cases where children felt their rights were violated.
One of the reasons why I'm so fascinated by this case and the other similar cases that I found is it's something that you just feel in your gut is totally wrong. And yet proving how it is wrong legally or who is wronged is really complicated. Yeah. I mean, what do you think What is wrong? What is the crime? Is it fraud? Is it assault? Is it theft of identity?
If I knew the answer to that question. But this question actually led me to start studying ethics because the law wasn't helping anymore. This goes to the question, what is actually harm in these cases? What's the harm if you're born in a certain situation that was not as you wanted it to be? And what kind of claims can you formulate as a child or an individual towards the ones who created you?
Laura was determined to build a case against Carbat on behalf of the donor-conceived people who'd approached her. But what kind of legal action could they bring? And who could represent them in court?
And we spent the next year or year and a half finding a lawyer willing to take on his case. That was really trying.
But eventually, they found someone.
My name is Tim Buters. I work in Holland as a lawyer. And a little firm called Rex Advocaten, Rex Lawyers.
Paul and I went to meet him at his office in the east of Holland, near the border with Germany.
And we are in a small town called Wijchen.
Wijchen?
Wijchen, yes.
Wijchen.
Yes.
Great.
Only 40,000 inhabitants.
Tim Butters sat across the boardroom table from us in a sharp great suit and a red tie, friendly but serious. He's a busy man. I had to email him 4 times and text him 2 times before he replied and agreed to an interview. He said he doesn't talk to international journalists, but he listens to a lot of podcasts, so he said he'd make an exception for us. In 2016, Tim agreed to meet up with a group of donor-conceived children and some of their parents who were all seeking justice. They got together in a hired conference room in Utrecht. It was the first time many of these people had met each other in person. Now they were face to face, sharing the most intimate details of how their families were made.
And they had a lot of questions.
There were suspicions, unease about how Carbat ran the clinic, but no concrete proof of anything yet.
Well, they asked me, I think the administration is not right.
They had concerns about a vital piece of paperwork called a donor passport.
And that's some basic information about the donor. It says his height, his weight, how old he is, if he's married or not, what his job is, the color of his hair and his eyes. And there were some examples where a mother asked for the donor passport right after the birth of the child. She got it. And when 16 years old, the child asked to the clinic for the donor passport and they sent it to her and it was completely different. It looked really like Carbat just made the passports up.
Other details emerged.
By then, they had suspicion that Carbat used his own semen. But the only reason that they told me was because the semen was warm when introduced.
So women felt that the semen was warm when it was put inside their bodies.
Carbat came from out of the other room and told them, now I really have good sperm and for sure you're going to get pregnant now because this sperm is excellent. Well, they had doubts about if that was correct and if it was the sperm that agreed upon. They were wondering, couldn't it be the sperm of Carbat himself?
Tim knew they needed more than rumours and suspicions if they were ever going to bring a case against Carbat. He needed the doctor's DNA to prove he actually was the father of his patient's babies. And he needed it quickly. Carbat was 88 in 2016. But getting him to agree to a DNA test seemed impossible.
From the beginning on, Carbat told us, well, it's not true and it's not possible because I lost my prostate I'm not fertile anymore, so I can't be the father of these children. But he wouldn't cooperate. So I thought, why do you don't want to cooperate? If it's not true, then you can prove it by working and cooperating with us. And when he didn't, I thought, well, maybe there's more about this.
That's true, actually, isn't it? It should be very, very simple. If he's not the father, just prove you're not the father.
Tim was determined to keep working on the case, even without a DNA sample. A year later, he was ready to bring legal action. Carbat's clinic had been closed for nearly a decade, but the doctor was still living in the same building, the stork still nailed to its roof.
I sent him a letter. In the letter, I told him, well, there's a lot of wrongdoings, and I advise you to send this to your insurance company. So, and I didn't get a letter back. Nothing. So then I called him.
And Corbat picked up the phone.
And he sounded very happy, strangely. He said, "Ah, Mr. Brutus, yes, I received your letter. Yes, yes, I sent it to my insurance company. Everything's right, okay."
The doctor seemed totally unfazed.
"Okay, thank you." The conversation was over. And I thought, well, it's not... there's something wrong with him, I think, because he's supposed to be scared now.
Tim didn't know it then, but this would be the last he ever heard from the doctor. In a matter of months, Corbat was dead.
So we had a big problem then. What to do?
Have you ever felt like escaping to your own desert island? Jane Gaskin did exactly that, trading in the family home to begin a new life in the tropics. But she soon discovers that paradise has its secrets. I'm Alice Levine, and this is The Price of Paradise, the island dream that ends in kidnap, corruption, and murder. Wish you were here? Follow The Price of Paradise now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
In spring 2017, children's rights activist Laura Bosch was working alongside Tim Butters to find legally admissible proof that Corbat used his own sperm to inseminate his patients. They were bringing proceedings to try and compel Corbat to provide them with a DNA sample.
Just a week before, we were finally ready with the civil suit or the file that would have been sent to Mr. Corbat to announce that we were trying to get him into court. And then all of a sudden, I was called by the lawyer, and he said, well, he actually died.
Some of the mothers heard that he died. Well, I thought, well, I don't know anything about it, and I didn't hear anything about it. There were no death certificates or nothing in the internet. So for us, he was still alive, but the rumors were so strong. My colleague just picked up the phone and called all the dead buriers.
They rang all the undertakers in the Rotterdam area.
And they asked them, did you bury Corbat? And then the last one we called, yes, 2 weeks ago, we had a funeral of Corbat in here. So then we knew.
I was born in Barendrecht, near the clinic. And for the first...
This is Inge Herlar, one of the 60-something Corbat kids, the one who came up with the tongue-in-cheek Keeping Up with the Corbastians reality TV idea we heard about in episode 4. She grew up in the same neighbourhood as the clinic.
I cycled to school every day near over the dike where the clinic was.
We're going to hear from Inge properly in the next episode, but I wanted to include part of her story now because she has a really unique connection to Corbat's death through the man who is her legal father.
My father has always worked as an undertaker. At some point he retired, but he was still working at the institute to help out and to drive the car.
Yeah. The hearse, yeah.
Yeah. I was there for dinner at Sunday. And he said, oh, you know who's in our cooler at the moment? The doctor. So we talked about it. He always talked about who's passed away in the village because it's a small village and he's helping out at the undertaker. And after the funeral, we found out that I was his daughter, his biological daughter. So my legal father has buried my biological father, which I think is hilarious. Don't you think?
But there was nothing for Tim to laugh about. His legal case had been thrown into crisis. Eventually, news of Corbat's death became public.
And afterwards, there was an article in the newspaper about it that the relatives kept it secret and just declared the news afterwards.
Why would they keep it secret?
I don't know.
It complicated the case extremely because part of our case was asking for his DNA. And seeing he was dead, it would become a different story. He could not consent to having his DNA being extracted with a mound swab.
But the mothers, fathers, and donor-conceived children still wanted to continue with the case.
23 persons wanted to start proceedings against Kabat to get his DNA to compare it to them.
They had three options.
Option one was to dig up the corpse of Kabat, but that would be really harsh.
We did not want to go there.
There was option two.
We tried to find an alternative way of getting DNA from Mr. Kabat by asking on television whether one of his family members would be willing to come forward and give his DNA.
None of Kabat's family responded to the appeal. But there was a third option.
We asked the judge for permission to go to the house of Kabat to get articles that were used by Kabat and to seizure them for evidence. 2 weeks after Kabat died, a bailiff rang on the door from Mrs. Kabat and he told her, yeah, we have to come in to get some stuff from your house. She said, oh, I denied you cannot go in. I don't want to cooperate. Four police officers went in and they searched every room, the bathroom, the bedroom, everything, and took the stuff from their house. A comb and a nose trimmer, things he used with DNA on it.
They seized the trimmer Corbett used to clip his nose hair. It still contained a few hairs. Would the doctor have ever thought this little personal hygiene device would betray him? But there were still legal hurdles to come. They'd won the right to seize his DNA, but not to test it.
The judge decided that we could get the DNA from these articles, but they had to go into the safe.
Corbett's defense lawyers were trying to stop anyone from accessing it. Tim would need to win his clients the right to have it released so it could be tested and eventually compared against the DNA of those who suspected he was their biological father.
It was a very tense situation. The public tribune was full of donor-conceived children, or individuals, I should say, with their families. They were all upset and they felt this was a moment where their story would be heard. The lawyer gave a very compelling speech about why this was a violation of the rights of these persons. And the lawyer of the estate of Mr. Kabat, and of his wife, she was very strong in denying everything. It was like a clash. There was this group of people who said something very bad has happened to us and we feel violated. And the other party said it did not happen. Why are you saying this? It was like a soap series.
2 years passed. And then, in February 2019, the judge gave her verdict.
She ruled in favor of that claim and everybody was cheering, basically. People were crying and falling in each other's arms. It was emotional. It truly was. I mean, people felt recognized. Of course, it wasn't closure for everything, but it was a landslide decision because for the first time, donor-conceived individuals got to claim something from their potential genetic father that was previously withheld from them.
Let me explain what Laura means here. In the Netherlands, only people conceived after 2004 have the right to know who their donor father is. This verdict was the first time donor-conceived adults born before 2004 were allowed to investigate the identity of their biological fathers. The old nose hair left in Corbett's trimmer gave them a right to know who they were that they never had before.
And I think that was reason why some people would cry when this verdict came about. And it was a very emotional setting and it meant a lot.
The hair was tested. And for the first time, after years of nagging doubts and suspicions, dozens of people could finally say for sure that Jan Corbett was their father. But there were still so many who felt denied justice, especially the women who'd been Corbett's patients.
What about the mothers, though? I mean, couldn't you make a good case to say that the mothers had been assaulted? Because whilst they
consented to the procedure. They didn't consent to that specific procedure. Something happened inside their bodies that they didn't want to happen.
Yeah, of course. Actually, the mothers that were donor conceived with the semen of Kabat, they told me I felt raped by him because I was there in a room naked, waiting for the treatment. He went in the room next door and he came back with warm sperm. And well, it feels like you can say a medical rape.
That's pretty much how Lydia had described her experience to me. She told me she was misused, abused by the doctor. Even though the mothers were clearly Cobat's victims, they were largely absent from the media coverage of the case. If you Google Cobat, you'll see image after image of the Cobat kids, of Cobat, the clinic, the court, and Tim in his suit. But no mothers. It seems strange to me, given what I'd seen about other cases abroad.
There have been American cases
yes.
of doctors fathering children mm-hmm. that they've helped create. And when I've read coverage of those cases, the focus is a lot on the mothers
yeah.
and the violation of the mothers. And that doesn't seem to be the case in how this has been looked at in this country. Can you explain that?
These cases were brought forward by a children's rights organization and donor-conceived individual organization. It wasn't a litigation for damages by the parents. This is a movement where donor-conceived individuals start to claim their rights.
Do you think in some respects that has denied the mothers the status of victimhood in the kind of wider public view here?
Yeah, of course, you're competing for the limelight. That's totally true. And I would have loved for a women's rights organization to step up and support, because we really should have those who are the victims speak for themselves and not for others. The same goes for the fathers. I would love for an organized men group to say, well, this is not how we perceive fatherhood in our society. And this is like a disrobing of what it means to be a father. Yes, please join the stage.
Why hasn't that happened?
I think there's still a taboo on procreation. And if it doesn't work out in your bedroom, you have to go and ask for help at the doctor's office. Yeah, that might hamper proactive position taking by these groups.
Now that Cobat is dead, no criminal charges can ever be brought against him. But there is an ongoing civil suit, a legal fight to claim damages against his estate and Rita Cobat as its executor. 53 plaintiffs, people conceived in the clinic, Cobat's former patients and their partners, are in the process of suing for the financial and emotional damages that the doctor inflicted on them. Joey is one of them.
So your case is against his estate and his family
yeah.
because you feel that they could have done more and could be doing more to put things right.
Yeah, yeah.
Is this about what you want is an admission of guilt and an apology? Or do you feel that money would make it right as well because you have expenses? I mean, what does justice look like for you?
For me, an apology, that's justice. And also an apology from the government, because they had to supervision all of what's happened, and they did not. But yeah, for my mom, I would like to have a financial compensation, because she's 66, and I don't think that a woman of that age should deal with this kind of problems.
What difference would compensation make to you?
I don't think that it makes a difference, but I think there has to be a compensation and for my mom or for the families that has affected by it. But yeah, that would not cover what happened, but that's something.
Since his death, much of the anger felt towards Jan Cobat has been redirected towards his widow, Rita. We tried to contact her. Her lawyer has said she won't talk to us. But how much did Rita really know? How much did any of the doctor's legal family know? There isn't much about Cobat's legal family in the public domain. None of his official children have ever given interviews. But we do know that Rita wasn't his first wife and that he had children in previous relationships. I thought nothing about Jan Korbach could surprise me anymore. Until Tim told me this.
Well, he had 22 children with three different spouses. And
he had 22 official legal children.
Yes.
I mean, surely this is building up a picture of somebody who really wants his DNA to remain on planet Earth.
If you add the 22 legal children Korbach had from his relationships to the 60 or so he fathered by deceiving his patients, that brings the total number of children of Korbach to well over 80. And Tim told me something else.
A child of Korbach, a normal child, a legal child, had given his DNA to FIOM database.
Mm.
And the FIOM database is the Dutch database for DNA.
It turns out that long before they got their hands on the nose hair trimmer, one of Korbach's legal children had already quietly come forward and volunteered his DNA to the official body that looks after donor-conceived children in the Netherlands. Of course, they still needed Korbach's own DNA to bring a legal claim against his estate, but the DNA from Korbach's son provided an important clue for those trying to piece together their identity.
Tell me about that son of Korbach. Do you know who it was?
No. No.
You don't know why he did it?
No, I don't know why he did it. Well, I can guess why he did it. But he gave his sperm to the DNA database and explicitly told them, you can only use it if Korbach, my father, has died.
But he's not spoken out at all or ever spoken publicly to explain?
No, no.
Because it's interesting, given that his family, his immediate family, as in his wife at the time of his death, and they were so protective of him and not wanting to cooperate with the case.
Yeah.
The idea that one of his children would go out on a limb and do this is very interesting.
Yes.
And there was something else that suggests that other people might have heard that Korbach was betraying his patients.
I get an anonymous audio tape.
He was told it was a recording of one of Korbach's legally recognized children.
Who was talking to a mother that thought that her child was from the doctor, and they spoke that they already knew in the family that there was something wrong.
Joey didn't share that recording with us, but someone else did. It's been circulating on WhatsApp and private Facebook groups. We think it was made around 5 years before Korbach's death, and that it's a recording of one of Korbach's many children from a previous relationship speaking on the phone to a woman who suspects she was inseminated with the doctor's sperm. We can't verify it conclusively, but we do think it's likely to be genuine. Many of the details revealed in the conversation, timelines and concrete facts, match what we've heard from other sources.
Ja, daar lijken mijn kinderen zo erg op.
To protect their privacy, we've decided not to reveal the gender of the Korbach child on the recording, and we've distorted their voice. But this is what we've learned. They back up what Tim told me about the number of official children Korbach fathered, and go even further, saying Rita is his fifth wife, and he has at least five children with all of them.
Ja, Rita is geloof ik zijn vijfde vrouw. En bij allemaal heeft hij minstens vier kinderen, geloof ik. En daarnaast heeft hij nog een paar buitenechtelijke van toen hij met mijn moeder getrouwd was.
They say he had a few extramarital children from when he was married to their mother, and that they know of at least 22 children Korbach conceived naturally.
Weet al van minstens 22 broers, half broers af.
Jeetje.
They confirm that a brother had donated his DNA to help people conceived in their father's clinic, because the brother was fed up with their father always getting away with everything and wanted the truth to one day come out. They say, my old man didn't live an honest life. He didn't approach things right. He misbehaved his whole life. He was always in a position to be able to. He's never really been punished. He got fired once when he was the director of a hospital by the head of the provincial states. So that's some sort of punishment. Look, he's an extremely intelligent guy, but he isn't burdened by conscience or honesty. He just isn't bothered. It resembles psychopathy. He experiences little guilt.
Yeah.
Next Next time, in our final episode. While the civil case rumbles on, I'll look at what the future holds for some of the people whose lives have been touched by Corbat in very different ways. The ones who worry how much of the doctor they might have inherited.
So you're paranoid that you might...
Absolutely paranoid. Yeah, that I'm narcissistic and that I'm so egoistic and... And not considering the feelings of somebody else, of other people.
The ones who can't escape the consequences of what he did.
Every single day, everything that I do, I'm reminded of what Corbat has neglected to do, basically.
And the ones whose lives are on hold because of him.
I think there is absolutely a chance of him being my dad.
The Immaculate Deception is a Something Else production. It was written and presented by me, Jenny Kleeman. Paul Smith is the producer, with additional production from Arlie Adlington. Mixing and sound design comes from Will Short at Spoke Media. The editor and executive producer is Peggy Sutton. Thank you to Magda Saron, Dan Cocker, Mark Rivers and Steve Ackerman. If you identify with any of the issues we're reporting on and have a story you'd like to share with us, our email address is deception@somethingelse.com.